The Meat for TCast is brought to you in part by Sone Lab, a recording studio in East Hampton, Massachusetts. Offering recording, mixing, and mastering of all styles of music, we even master podcasts. Email info@sonelab.com for more information. That's info@sonelab.com.
That's the record button. Have we started?
We have started.
So, this is the Meat for TCast. You might always start like that. Who knows?
Hello, hello.
Hello.
Welcome to the Meat for TCast. I'm Mark Allen Miller.
I am Elizabeth McDuffie. And this is...
Season 4, episode...
18.
I know, it's crazy.
I wonder how many episodes we're up to now.
Oh, I don't know. Probably getting up there towards 100.
Yeah, we're going to have to start making plans for our special 100th episode. Still thinking about what to do. If you have ideas about what you'd like us to do, that'd be a very cool thing to leave us a voice memo on.
Well, you can record it on your phone and send it to meatfortcast@gmail.com.
Yeah. Why don't you do that? Why don't you send us your votes for what you wish we'd do?
Here, pause
for the 100th episode.
Pause the podcast right now. We'll be here. Pause it. Go do it. Come back.
Or do it after you listen.
You can do that too.
But do it soon. You could also message us. And I'd rather have your voice memo, but if for some reason you're shy about your voice on the air, you could just email it to meatfortcast@gmail.com. Or you could just message the Meat for TCast Facebook page. You follow that page, right? You've seen the calls for six-word stories and been enjoying the content there.
What? You don't? Okay, we can pause the podcast, switch over to Facebook.
Stop telling me to pause the podcast, seriously. Don't do that. Don't listen to him. Don't pause the podcast. That's not happening.
Oh, clearly you're still listening, so it's all good. So, yeah.
Well, first, I'd like to thank some very generous benefactors.
Okay.
Because there's some folks that have donated very generously to Meat for Tea, and that really helps me breathe a lot easier when I'm gathering the monies I'll need to bring to Paradise Copies, who prints our lovely Perfect Bound magazines. So without further ado, I'd like to very much thank Elizabeth Applequist and Jeffrey Feingold for being such generous benefactors.
Mm-hmm. It's really an honor to actually be so well appreciated by people where they help us out. It's great.
We try to live up to it.
We do. By doing things like this, the podcast. So before we get into housekeeping, who do we have today?
Well, today we have Joshua Michael Stewart and Rick Parr. Rick Parr published God Bless America and Breakfast Burritos to Go with us, Meat for Tea Press, not so long ago. And Joshua Michael Stewart has a new book called Love Something. And the two of them are teaming up. They're going to be giving a reading called In Time and Place tomorrow night.
Which could be tonight if you're hearing this tomorrow.
Yeah, if you're local and you're hearing this.
It could have been yesterday if you're hearing this Wednesday. But that's Tuesday
it's going to be in the show notes.
Yeah. Right. So it'll be this Tuesday. Or it was this Tuesday.
Well, if you're local and you're hearing this, it drops, run. Run, catch the reading. Check our show notes. So, all the best ways to support us can be found on the website at meatfortea.com. meatfortea.com. We're running a special in our spring store, 20% off discount. There's all sorts of groovy things there. Aprons and hoodies and pint glasses and mugs and tote bags. And the discount code for that is MeatJoy, MeatJoy.
Yep. And enter MeatJoy in the checkout and get 20% off your purchase. And the warm, cozy feeling of knowing you've helped support Meat for Tea and the Meat for Tea cast and everything we do for you. So I think with that, we should just tuck right into this episode. It's a lovely conversation. I'm almost finished editing it as we're recording this right now. And it's a real treat.
Conversation with readings from their great books.
So here's Elizabeth with Rick Parr and Joshua Michael Stewart.
It is my pleasure and honor to welcome Rick Parr and Joshua Michael Stewart. Joshua Michael Stewart's most recent book is Love Something. And Rick Parr's, which he published with Meat for Tea Press, is God Bless America and Breakfast Burritos to Go. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Psyched to have you. You guys are doing a joint reading coming up very soon. You want to tell us about that?
Go for it, Joshua.
Well, it is titled In Time and Place, Poetry and Prose with Rick Parr and Joshua Michael Stewart. It will be at the East Longmeadow Public Library, February 21st at 6:30 p.m. And the East Longmeadow Public Library is at 60 Center Square, East Longmeadow, Mass.
Right near the World's Worst Rotary.
Cool. I hope to be able to attend. We'll see. It depends.
We hope you and others will be able to attend.
Yeah. Well, this episode will drop prior to that, so our local listeners can make a note, and we'll be sure to put that in our show notes too.
That'd be great.
I love the name of the reading. Was that both of your brainchild?
I think that was Joshua's, wasn't it?
Yeah, I guess that was mine. You know, the way this came about is, you know, as you know, Rick's book was recently released, and he asked if I wanted to do some readings with him. So reading through his book, you know, I would try to find a theme of some kind that, you know, we could bounce our readings off each other, because, you know, he's, you know, his book is more, you know, what would be considered like travel writing or memoir. Mm-hmm. And of course, I'm a poet. And, you know, reading his book, you know, as it's a travel journal, more or less, you know, obviously time and place is very thematic within his book. You know, I as people who know my work, time and place also plays a big theme in many of my poems. So when we read together, I will be reading my poems, you know, from all three of my books that are deal with that theme.
Wonderful.
I asked Joshua if he wanted to do this together, because I've loved Joshua's work since the first time I saw him, probably, was 6 or 7 years ago, Joshua? Something like that?
It's something like that, yeah. I'm not too sure how long.
At a variety of different open mic nights. And I fell in love with the rhythms and the pounding and the gut punching that I felt when I heard him read. And it was pretty good, damn good. So I'm glad he said yes.
I am too. I think it's a good pairing.
I do too.
There's a lot of connective tissue, and I don't know that a lot of people would naturally think that a prose memoir and a poet would have prose memoirist and a poet would have that much connective tissue in common, but I think you really do.
I think so too. Joshua is a terrifically prose poetry writer, and I'd like to think some of the stuff that I write in prose have kind of a poetic twist to them. At least some of the sentences, I try to get them to be, I don't try them, they turn out to be kind of rhythmic, and the words matter, and I'll shut up there.
Yeah, and plus, you know, like my first book, Break Every String, was more or less a memoir in verse. So, you know, we have that memoir thing in common.
Right.
Well, you deal a lot also in haiku and correct my pronunciation if necessary, Senru?
Yeah, I mean, you know, nowadays, I guess the school of thought is that the two are so closely intertwined now that they're all just called haikus. I guess some people like to make a big distinction, but I don't. It's like with high buns. A high bun technically is prose that has a haiku at the end or within the in between the paragraphs. And if it's a tanka, then it's no longer a high bun. It's called a tanka prose, which to me, that's just hair splitting. You know, if I write a tanka prose, I would just call it a high bun. I've written high buns where within each paragraph, between the paragraphs, it alternates between haikus and tankas. So, you know, what the hell would you call that? But yes, I do write high buns and I do write haikus as well.
Right. Do you mind just for our listeners giving little working definitions of high bun, tanka, haiku, and I know the distinction's fading away, but senru, I just think some people might be edified.
Okay. So, well, the haikus is, you know, the three line, you know, traditional Japanese poems, you know, they would say you would read books that say it has to do with 17 syllables, but you know, again, the syllable thing has been thrown out the window because it was never even meant to be 17 syllables. It was sound units, which is completely different in Japan than in English. So it doesn't even completely translate. And haikus are specifically more based in nature, whereas senru's has more to do, it's basically a haiku, except it has more to do with human nature rather than nature. And a haibun is, it's prose with a haiku. It's usually like with Basho and Aissa, they were actually in their travel journals. And they would have their travel journals and prose, and then to kind of sum up, to either sum it up or to give more, to be more precise, to give like a juxtaposition. At the end of their travel journal entry, they would have a haiku. And a tanka prose is the exact same thing, except having a tanka at the end. And a tanka is a five-line traditional Japanese poem. And off the top of my head, that's all I... It's off the top of my head, that's basically the definition. It's if you look at it, it also has to do with the renku, which is the linked poems, which is a very complex. It was like a party game in ancient Japan.
How cool.
And where it was a three-line poem and a two-line poem, and then they would alternate and link. And so it would be like Rick would give a three-line poem, and then I would give a two-line poem, and then you would give a three-line poem, and it would just continuously link. But there were all these rules. And basically, the tanka, I believe, is like where someone just had the first three lines and the next two lines. And that's a really poor description of it. There's more to it. People can look up what a tanka is. Check it out on Wikipedia. And for modern tanka, there's very little journals. There's The only regular journal I can think of that is just specifically on tankas is called Ribbons, which is published by the Tonka Society of America, or Americans, yeah, something like that. The Tonka Society of America. So, and there is a Tonka anthology that's really good. Of course, I can't remember the name of it, but I know it can be found on Amazon.
If it occurs to you, you can just email it to me and we can put the name of it in the show okay. notes before we drop the episode. And I thank you for that. Like, you're my haiku master. I'm so grateful for the very detailed email you sent me when I'm like, hey, I'd like to educate myself more about this art form. And yeah. next thing I know, I have this like very detailed 4-page
yeah.
scholarly letter.
Yeah, because then you got classical Chinese poetry and of course that influenced all the Japanese writers. And I mean, there's so much great stuff out there. And it's in, you know, obviously you are dealing with modern translations, but when you read the translations, like a lot of the poems, you know, they're over 500 years old, but they sound so modern. You would never know, you know, you would never know they were so old. They just seem so fresh, you know, right here and now.
Yeah. Do you think that immediacy is due to the form, just observing in a moment what's happening, whether being in nature or?
Well, yes, because, you know, it is, you know, very nature oriented, which, you know, nature hasn't changed that much. So, you know.
Well, except for, you know, California wasn't always on fire all the time.
Right.
There's, well, yes. There's a few changes that are observable.
You know, that feeling you get when you first see a sunrise after a snowstorm. And, you know that feeling. And then when when Basho speaks of it, you know exactly what he is feeling and what he's talking about. So people can relate to those type of nature things. But also, again, you know, especially with Basho and all the other, or at least most of the Japanese writers, they were all Buddhists, or at least influenced by Buddhism. So the whole thing about being in the moment, you know, is a Buddhist thing. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that brings in the immediacy of the poems.
Yeah. Thanks for all that. And people should really just kind of throw that 5-7-5 rule they were taught maybe in elementary school out the window. Is that correct?
Yes. Because again, it was never about 17 syllables. It was about 17 sound units, which is completely different than what a syllable is in the Japanese language. So it's not really important. And plus, when people try to adhere to the form, to the syllables, it just makes the poems sound clunky.
Mm-hmm.
And people also tend to do, you know, they kind of do the whole, someone called it like tanto talking, you know?
I love that.
They, you know, cut out words to fit the syllable count, and all you get is like, me hungry now, eat food, you know? So.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Like all poetry, like all writing, your best teacher is reading.
Mm-hmm.
You know, read the classics, read modern things. The best journal, if you really want to study haibuns and haikus, the best journals out there is Frog Pond and Modern Haiku. There is contemporaryhighbunonline.com, which is all about, is just strictly contemporary high buns. So you could, you know, listeners could start there. And again, you, there's all the classical writers. There's, you know, even the Chinese writers. There's Li Po, Wang Wu, and of course, everyone else that I'm forgetting about. Mm-hmm. But there's just so much out there.
Thank you. I feel really edified. Yeah, I want to at some point subscribe to Frog Pond if, when I'm feeling like I'm, like I've got some extra money banging around.
Mm-hmm.
It's not often that a small publisher feels like they have extra money banging around, which might come as a surprise to some people that small literary journal editors and small press publishers aren't loaded, but we're not. And if you've ever got a high bun or a Tonka looking for a home, Joshua, Meet for Tea would gladly find a home for one or two or six.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely. And you guys both have published in Meet for Tea several times over the years.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Starting, how far back? Rick, when did you first publish in Meet for Tea?
Oh, well, it was before the pandemic.
Definitely, right?
That's... takes us back 3 years plus. So probably 2-3 years before, maybe 5 years, 6 years, something like that.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm older than you are. And it, I was just talking to my friend when we were walking today, how quickly it goes when you get older. I said, Christ, it's like the almost the end of February now. It feels like it was Thanksgiving yesterday.
Well, you know? it's just at the halfway mark today. It's not quite almost the end. I'm not going to rush through those 2 weeks. we still have... more time.
2 weeks are already gone. Already gone.
No. You're speeding it up. And Joshua, you've been publishing Meet for Tea for years now.
Yeah, I just pulled out the first issue I was in, which was volume 13, issue 4.
Wow. And we're getting ready to release volume 17, issue 1 this March. It'll turn 17. Now, Rick, you are very active in Straw Dog Writers Guild.
Yes.
And are you too, Joshua? Are you part of
it? Yes, I am.
You both are. Okay, that's what I thought.
Totally by accident.
Tell me the story. How did that accident happen?
Well, I was writing some stories and wanted some place to read them. And the first place I went to was up in Wendell, in the middle of nowhere. And I was scared to death. Leave puddles where my hands were, very scared, but enjoyed it. And then I went to Greenfield and was reading there, enjoyed that too with Paul.
Nice.
And then found that they had an open mic night in Northampton, which is, I live down near Springfield, so it's a shorter drive than going to Greenfield or Wendell. And it was in the basement lounge. God, I love that place. It was sticky floors and ugly and weird.
Stinky.
And rotten and beautiful.
Stinky.
Perfect. Stinky, of course. I love that best. So I started reading there. And then somebody who was the MC didn't come in. And I was asked if I wanted to be the MC. And I said, what do I have to do? And they said, you have to introduce people. I said, hell, I can do that. here's Joshua. And that led to one thing after another. And I ended up being on a bunch of committees and the board of directors and the steering committee and stuff, and much too much Zoom right now, but I've enjoyed it. I've loved meeting the people that I've met, amazingly good talent up and down the valley that if it were someplace else, you would say, oh my God, they're so good. But because they're local, you kind of forget that, kind of like your publishing house too. Like it does a tremendously good product for one, but also it's just good to have it, you know, and it's appreciated. And you turn out really good stuff.
Aww.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
So that's how I got involved in it. And still am. So I like, and I retired from my job almost 4 years ago and has needed something to fill the hours. So it's been Straw Dog Writers Guild, happily.
Yeah, fantastic. Now, do you have a specific titled role, or is everyone just a Straw Dog Writers Guild member? I should know these things. I have at times had a little membership in exchange for an ad barter. See if they'll do that again. That's how I do it. I don't pay dues. I stick an ad in. I get to be a member.
Yeah, I have a title. I'm on the board of directors.
Right.
So that's one.
And that's pretty fancy.
Two or three or four other committees, but yeah. So I guess I have a. But if you belong, it's a really good thing. There's like over 300 members, which is pretty good for this area. Yeah, happy with it.
It's a cool thing.
It is.
And I'm just a member. I'm not on the board or have a title or anything like that.
You're just a member with three really awesome books under his belt.
Well, thank you. And I did find that anthology, that Tonka anthology.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and it's simply called the Tonka Anthology, and it's edited by Michael McClinock, Pamela Miller Ness, and Jim Cassian.
Nice.
And it's by it's published by Red Moon Press, which is a great press, and they're actually out of Winchester, Virginia.
Huh. Yeah. That's a surprise. How many places have wonderful presses, little small out of the way places? Probably so many.
Yeah.
So I think we should start ducking into your books a bit. And you guys are welcomed to treat this episode as a practice for your reading that's coming up.
All right. So Joshua, since you're kind of like following me and trying to figure out something that would work with what I've read, let me go first?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, glasses on. Okay, so this is just a couple, two, 3 minutes long. It's from my story, and just as a background here, I stumbled on a crazy festival for people who were rescuing greyhounds. It was in a small beach community in Delaware, and I stumbled on it and was shocked by it. 4,000 greyhounds, about 1,000 people, and they were everywhere. You couldn't go to dinner without a dog looking at you. You couldn't go to the bathroom without a dog looking at you. You couldn't wake up in the morning, walk down the halls without like a whole slew of dogs waiting to get in to get their toenails clipped. And I went back 2 years later to kind of embed myself in the thing, like, because I could not understand it. I mean, I had a dog. I loved my dog. But these guys were just like over the moon. They would rescue 2, 3, 12, 15 of them and all at once. And I was just shocked. So I went back down and kind of embedded myself with these people, got down there before they started, left when the last day was there. It was about 5 days I was there, and tried to just understand what this was. So anyhow, just as a little taste of what the place was like. There were two, what the hell's the word? It was a clairvoyant, that's right, who had a social work degree, which I found interesting. I'm leaving her and going down the stairs. On the way down the stairs, I pass a man with a smallish greyhound who's next in line. Later in the day, outside of the Greyhound Reiki's workshop, I see the man with the smallish greyhound again. I ask him why he saw the psychic social worker. Jason's having trouble adjusting to our family, and I wanted to see how he was feeling. Well, Jason's from Spain, a Galgo greyhound who never raced. He was kept in a pen like it was Auschwitz, the man growls. Apparently, there were hundreds of dogs, many very aggressive. And when food was tossed into the middle of the tight pack, a steel cage death match ensued, a cross between Darwin and the World Wrestling Federation. Some dogs ate well and grew fat, and others shrank and died. The man adopted Jason last summer, skinny but alive. The man is no fan of the Spanish. Do you know what they do for fun, for good luck? They hang a dead greyhound by the neck from a tree or something like that. I'm not sure what he's saying because I'm still stuck on the image of 100 dogs fighting for food, which makes me think about what another man told me this morning. Greyhounds being piled up dead, 50 at a time, in the back of a pickup, being driven from the track to a pit. And the next thing I know, my brain has wandered off to my friend Joe, in his father's life as a kid in the Nazi labor camp, slashed with a bayonet, beaten but alive, unlike his family, all murdered and dumped on a pile of other dead people, like they're shit-stained laundry. What the hell is it with humans? I'm pulled back from my drift when the man says, maybe it can help Jason. What can, I ask. Reiki. I had it done to me a few years ago, and it felt pretty good. Has any of this stuff worked? The psychic, the massages, I ask. I don't know yet, he says, but the man seems to have faith that it will. He seems to have faith particularly in the social worker, because she told me something that no one else could have ever known. What's that, I ask. She told me that Jason has an eating disorder, and I'm shocked, as Claude Rains said in Casablanca. But she was wrong about her other dog, he says quietly. She said that her other dog has ADD, which is a real lazy bones, a total couch potato. I'll stop there.
Thank you so much. I love this book. Of course I love this book. It's got Meat for Tea Press on it. I only publish what I love.
That's right. Thank you.
That is the rule. God, those images too. And, you know, I cynically think that I'd have a much fatter wallet and a fuller bank account maybe if I just became a dog Reiki practitioner.
You know, they had lines out the door.
Also, your patients can't really tell anyone if your treatments are effective or not.
It's true. There was a woman I met there who was almost exactly my age, and she had had a big job in New York City making a lot of money, and she got just sick to death of it. But she had a greyhound that she liked a lot. And then she thought, I like one greyhound. I think I'll get two. And she ended up with 36 greyhounds, and she moved out to Kanab, Utah, where she did greyhound rescues, and just quite a very smart and wonderful person. But I could not get my arms around the idea of 36 greyhounds in your backyard. So I drove out to Kanab to talk to her and find out, how'd she do it? How did she quit her job midlife? Because I was feeling the same sort of feelings about my job, which was being a college professor, not quite in love with it anymore and wanting to do something else. So she was my go-to answer. Not that she supplied an answer, but I liked what she did.
Yeah, it's intriguing. Well, Joshua, do you want to follow that up with something that you're going to be reading?
Yes, and this format that we're doing is, when most there's, a double header, reading feature, usually one author will go up and read his 15, 20 minutes, and then the next reader will go and read their next 15, 20 minutes. But, we thought to keep it interesting, and I suggested it, but in all fairness, I stole this from Doug Anderson. Because I did a reading once with Doug Anderson where what we did was he would read a poem and then I would read a poem and then we just kept switching on and off. And it was great because, he would read a poem that had, a cardinal in it. And I'd be like, I got a poem that has a cardinal in it too. So I would hurry up and read that poem and then, I think it just keeps it more interesting. So when people do come to our reading, we will do it in this fashion where he will read a portion of his book and then I will read a poem or two in between.
I love that.
And take questions.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So this poem is from my new book called Love Something.
Which I got to interrupt is like a great title. Love Something.
So good.
Yeah.
And I love the cover image too.
Oh, yeah.
Which I know that makes great audio, describing a cover image. Yeah. I'm sure our listeners are really enjoying that. But Love Something.
Yeah, and the photo is also was actually also taken by Doug Anderson.
Oh, how cool. But just this broken down truck, and I just love that. So Love Something and sort of unspoken, even this.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how it's you can actually see the truck. It's actually sinking into the ground.
Yeah.
It's like the earth is like, taking it in.
It's being swallowed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyways, the poem I'm going to read is keeping on that theme of time and place. This poem is called Buried Deep as a Bullet. I wrote it for the Native American poet Adrian C. Lewis, who I was fortunate enough to communicate with on a handful of times. I even tried to see if he would come out to our area to do a reading. I believe he lived in Arizona or somewhere out west, in maybe Oklahoma. But by the time I asked him, his health wasn't that good, and he actually ended up passing away not too long after that. But anyways, his poems are, not all of them, but a lot of his poems read like you're stumbling on someone's letter. A lot of his poems read like letters that he would have written to his wife or his mother or to someone. And in this poem, I tried to capture that same style.
Cool.
So anyways, this is Buried Deep as a Bullet for Adrian C. Lewis. Adrian, when my mother told me my great-grandfather was a full-blooded Sioux, my only question was, when can I get a horse and a bow and arrows? If she said our ancestors were dragons, I would have shot snot out of my nose to breathe fire. But the stupid kid, me, grew up and stopped believing everything his mother says. He became a stupid adult who believes in nothing except death. He wonders what a Sioux was doing farming tobacco in Kentucky hills. Wonders about documents that prove tribal enrollment, reservation, assignment, and finds nothing but family folklore. It's one thing to dream you're a star quarterback, and another to believe you were always on the team, and then learn you never even made the roster. There's a pride that doesn't belong to you. Just another thing white men have stolen. I carried that pride jutting out of my breast pocket, pulled it out at kindergarten show and tell, scratched a black X on my college application. I love to hate the other side of me, the white side of me, the forked tongue, the Wazichu. By the time I was 10, I could name more warriors and chiefs at the Battle of Little Bighorn than I could name U.S. presidents. I often dreamed of pissing on Custer's grave. In the third grade, my teacher displayed Thanksgiving cutouts, turkeys and cornucopias, pilgrims and multicolored corn. I told her about my great-grandfather, and she said, "You must be very proud," and I was. And I loved my great-grandfather more than anyone else, dead a year before I was born. I sat tall in my seat, raised my hand high when there was a picture of a buffalo in the textbook. My whole body shimmied when the teacher turned my way. I was ready to be called to the front to lecture on what it was like to be one of America's first people. But instead, she said, "Thanks to the Indians, bison almost went extinct."
Oh my God.
My jaw unlatched. I shook my head because even in third grade, I knew the fur trade wiped out the buffalo. But before I could speak my utter disgust, she shot a finger in my direction and said, "Keep quiet. You don't know everything about Indians." Mm-hmm. I told my mother and she was irate, but not enough to go down there and knock the teeth out of that bitch's mouth. Hell, if the teacher said that shit today, she'd be out of a job, slapped with a lawsuit, but not in 1982. It turns out I wasn't even Native. By the time I learned of this, the last thing I wanted to be was exactly what I was, a white guy who called himself Indian. I stopped talking about my great-grandfather, going to powwows, searching for some kind of connection through thunder drum and ancestral song. Stopped thinking I belonged. But Adrian, that teacher's sneer is buried deep as a bullet, unremovable, too close to the spine, even if it wasn't meant for me.
Damn.
Yes. That's so powerful.
Ouch, boy.
I know.
And one thing I meant to say beforehand that I forgot is that the word Wazichu is, it's Lakota, and it translates for what's the Lakota word for people of Western European descent. It is often translates to "he takes fat."
Wow.
How do you pronounce that again?
Wazichu.
Wazichu.
Yeah.
Fun fact, my dad, the very Reverend Dr. Bruce McDuffie, 86-year-old Episcopalian minister, speaks Lakota.
Huh, really?
He learned it. He did his seminary and had his first posts in North Dakota, and he spent a lot of time on Lakota and Sioux reservations and presiding over funerals, and made friends with Ron Little Owl, a medicine man, and just really got well acquainted with the community and learned to speak Lakota.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly where they are, but I know the two biggest Sioux reservations is Pine Ridge and Rosebud.
South Dakota, right along the Nebraska border.
Is that, South Dakota or North Dakota?
Yeah. South Dakota, yeah.
Yeah.
Down in the Badlands, I would imagine.
Just before you get to them.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
A couple of years ago, I was just driving out west and used to live in Nebraska in the northeast corner. I was only a licensed psychologist in a 40-mile radius. Ha. Huh. Anyway, so I was visiting where I used to live, and then driving along Route 20, just same as our Route 20, but it was in the middle of nowhere, and getting the Indian station, that First Nation station, and it was pretty cool. It was just right across the border.
Yeah. That's awesome. Your poem also, Joshua, reminded me, I don't know if you've read the book, I think it's an important book for everyone to read, by Jesse Daniels, Nice White Ladies, which is an exploration of just culturally inherent and embedded racism.
I haven't heard of it, but I will have to check it out.
It's important. I think it's really cool. And one thing she talks about, and she draws, it's not a preachy pointing fingers like I'm so much more woke and unracist than you. She goes into her history and explores her own background, and her family had this lore of a Native American, I believe it was a great grandmother, which further exploration proved to be completely untrue. And what she found out is there's kind of this American tradition of having a fabricated Native American grand or great grandparent,
mm-hmm.
which is so weird, also like rich fodder for all kinds of thinking and writing. But even in Mark's family, he thought until recently there was Native American blood, but I think it was 23andMe, one of his brothers did, turned up that, nope, there isn't any.
Well, see, here's the thing with that. It gets even more complex.
Of course.
Because the DNA test doesn't prove anything.
Right.
Because the problem with the DNA test is there's not enough native DNA within the database to determine.
Wow.
So you can still have native DNA within you, but it just won't show up. It won't register. Right. So it doesn't prove anything.
Oh, wild.
Right. And also too, with my family history, is it's a little more complex because yes, my mom always told me that my great grandfather was a Sioux. And then as I got older and started learning more, about different Native American cultures and where people come from and stuff. And like, you know, even if you're a Native and even if you've never lived on a reservation, if you've never set foot on a reservation, you're still assigned to one. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, well, if especially if he was a Native born in around the 1890s, early 1900s, he definitely would be assigned to a reservation. So which one would that have been? And he was a Kentucky tobacco farmer. What is a Sioux, again, especially around 1900, doing in Kentucky? Not saying that, you know, he couldn't travel from, you know, South Dakota to Kentucky, but the likelihood is it's very
slim.
Rare. Yeah. And so then when I started asking these hard questions, it was everything is hearsay and no one has actual proof of anything. But, you know, you look at pictures of my great grandfather and he is definitely dark skinned. Mm. And more likely what he is if he was Native, he wasn't Sioux, but he was Cherokee.
Right.
And there's a group of Cherokees, a branch of Cherokee that went, you know, they originally came from Georgia, but then they moved up into the Appalachians of Kentucky and Tennessee.
Yep.
And they settled there. So, you know, he could have been Cherokee.
Let's go with that.
Yeah.
That's such interesting stuff, though. So rich. I love that. So what are we going to hear next?
Would you like to hear the other half of how people treat greyhounds? So on one hand, you had all these people just absolutely adoring their dogs. They're loving them, tender to them. They're part of the family.
Getting them Reiki.
Right. All that stuff. It was cool. Actually, it surprised me how much I liked it after I got to the last day. So I thought I'd take a look at what it was like to go to a greyhound racing track. At the time, there was one up in Hinsdale, New Hampshire, right over the line. It's now long gone. So I spent a week up there too. I'd go up. I went every day. Well, 5 days, watching these people. Well, here goes. Ready?
Sure.
Okay. The sun is big and glowing, and seems to be stalled over Vermont, just a few hundred yards west of here on the other side of the Connecticut River. Two bareheaded old people from inside have moved partway outside into a thin sliver of shade. I take a spot at an empty plastic table on the far right side of the patio, down by the rail next to the smooth, dry dirt track. Bored kids wearing green polo shirts and tan khaki pants parade bored dogs on leashes up and down the track, making sure to pause before us so that we might what? What are we supposed to be looking for? How do you tell one greyhound from another? They still look alike to me, the way they did in Dewey. Big and ugly and no personality. But right at this moment, dressed in their racing colors, the dogs are Roman gladiators marching around the Colosseum before the death matches. Either that or Miss America contestants walking the runway. An old woman sitting by herself eats hot chili and smokes a cigarette in the miserable heat. A disembodied male voice on the loudspeaker, bored and torpid and gravelly, begins to speak and I cannot understand a word he says. It sounds appropriately like a bus station intercom voice, 4 a.m, filled with sleep, not wanting to be here, counting the hours until the new guy arrives. Two of the kids who paraded the dogs in front of us a few minutes ago hold muzzles in their hands and run down the track as fast as they can. One kid peels off at the finish line in front of me, and the other kid, much fatter and extremely sweaty, waddles farther down the track past the first turn. I watch the fat kid until he stops. Then Jesus Christ, they're fast! When I turn around, the greyhounds have already finished the first quarter of the race, moving past the patio and the four of us outside in the fierce sun. Down at the first turn in a tight NASCAR dog pack, dog number 3 cartwheels in the air and lands on his feet like it was planned, and I whisper a little cheer, "Go, number 3, go!" But number 2, who has led from the start, is much faster than all the other dogs, and his lead gets increasingly large until it gets so large that on the back stretch, he begins to look around like he's lonely, like he wants a friend, like he wants some other dog to play with. And while number two pauses, number eight on the outside breezes right by, as do three others, and number two finishes fifth, two spots ahead of the acrobatic number three. And everywhere there is silence. No racing hooves, no snorting, no jockeys going to the whip, and there's absolutely no crowd noise either. No one cheers. No one makes a sound. This is not a crowd behavior I'm familiar with. I'm trying to think of a sport where the fans are this quiet. Golf? Not anymore. Tennis? No. Chess. Yes, chess. Matinee greyhound races sound a lot like chess, only not as loud. I hear two guys near me talking, and I turn to take a peek. One man is, of course, very old. Nearly everyone is. The other is in his late 30s, small, barely 5 foot tall, and his chin seems to have been swallowed into his neck. In a thick New England accent, he talks about the incredibly fast but all too sociable dog number two. I'd straighten him out in a hurry. I'd take a gun or a bat and boom, he wouldn't do that again, that's for sure. He has a weird chuckle when he says this, kind of like an old-time movie villain. The younger guy keeps talking, angrily moving from animal cruelty to liberal Massachusetts politicians, even though Mitt Romney is our governor. All those taxes and they can't fix the goddamn roads. I stand up to take a longer look and see that he's a sorry little man who's probably been ignored by everyone except for this old man who's trying hard to ignore him too, but the little man holds him by the arm and won't let him leave. A very large GMC pickup truck with big water tanks smooths the track for the next race, and the bus station voice begins. Again, I cannot make out what he says, and a couple tables to my left, the old woman keeps eating hot chili, and between plastic spoonfuls, she fires up yet another cigarette.
Oh, yay. So my poetry slam snaps. They're muffled for some reason in the mic. I love that so much.
Thank you. Quite a difference between the two groups of people. And there's love and there's hate, and they were the same animals.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the people that are the different animals, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's a very sad place.
I love the way that was written.
Thank you.
It's kind of a conversational tone.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that so much.
Thanks.
And we'll be back in just a moment.
We have a very generous partner to Meet for Tea. We really appreciate them very much because It's through ad support that we stay in print. So without further ado, let me tell you about Sucre Bay. Sucre Bay is perfume made by weirdos like you. And they're a cruelty-free, women-owned indie perfume and body products company who love making people smell good. Each scent is crafted by hand in their Washington State lab located in the woods. And honestly, I don't know where else you can find fragrances with names like Sea Hag, Don't Panic, Siren Song, Goth as Fuck. Those are just a few of their best sellers.
So great.
They have all sorts of other things too, bath care products. And also they partner with a lot of interesting people, including our friend Sarah McCartney of 4160 Tuesdays. Sucre Bay is one of the few places in the States you can get yourself some 4160 Tuesdays fragrances.
Yes. So head on over to sucrebay.com. Check out their wares. And we thank them
for the show notes for the proper spelling.
Mm-hmm. And thank you very, very much.
Should I do it on Sucre Bay now?
Oh, yeah. You know what? How's it spelled?
Yeah. So if you just go to sucrebeille.com, that'll get you there.
Yeah. We really appreciate their support. Thank you so much, Sucre Bay.
Thank you so much, Sucre Bay. We love you.
And welcome back.
Your turn.
Yeah, Joshua, what you got?
Okay, well, so
game on.
This is a perfect example of how the conversation can influence what I will choose to read. So, since of what he read and also our conversation of High Buns, I decided that I'm going to read a brand new High Bun that I just wrote in the last couple weeks. So this isn't even in any of my books yet. And this is the first time I've, in fact, I've ever even read it.
I'm honored.
Exciting.
So if it's awful, it is all your fault.
Bad audience. Right?
Heavy is the head that wears the crown.
That's right.
All right. So this is a traditional high bun that actually has a haiku at the end, not a tanka. And it's entitled Isabel for Mary Lou. We feed wild turkeys at the office. They strut down the sidewalk and stare at us through windows, their big eyes blinking. Their heads move with our movements, and they trot to meet us at the double doors when they see us get up from our chairs. We toss them bread, stale bagels, crackers left over from the last staff meeting, cheese platter. A coworker feeds them salted peanuts from a large jar she stashes in her desk drawer. One hen we've named Isabel walks with a limp and has a messed up wing. She's not plump like the others. Sometimes she's among the flock, but off to the side. Mostly she comes alone. We try to feed her a little more than the rest. I'll make a separate breadcrumb pile and stand between her and the flock so she can eat peacefully. The gobblers puff their feathers and fan their tails, but keep their distance. Over the weekend, an Arctic blast ripped through the region, plummeting the temperatures to life-threatening levels. Frostbite could set in within minutes. Pipes froze. Car batteries died. I worried about the turkeys, especially Isabel. I knew they'd huddle together for warmth, but would they include her or push her aside? Would she survive bitter, cold indifference? I couldn't stop thinking about her. Monday arrives. Sun blazes. The temperature jumped up 40 degrees. I climb from my car to go into the office, and heading straight toward me is Isabel, her legs moving as fast as they can, even with a limp, her weight shifting side to side with every step. She stops 2 feet in front of me, flaps her wings, and purrs. Come on, Isabel, I say as I walk to the front entrance. Her feet click on the sidewalk behind me. Childhood winters. The friend I couldn't save from angry winds.
Ooh.
Yeah, that works.
Love it. The submission deadline for the dark issue of Meat for Tea is the 18th.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that could find a home in the dark issue.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
I love it.
It's beautiful.
Poor Isabel.
Yeah.
We'll all bow our heads. So powerful.
Way to go.
Yeah.
And that's brand new, huh?
Yep.
Well, I'm honored to have heard it with the first time here with my friend.
Me too.
Thank you.
Me too. That's huge. So can you guys believe we've been at this for over an hour?
Wow.
It goes fast. It actually goes kind of fast. I'm always like, can I fit in more readings? But one thing, I as you know, I don't interview. I do like to just get you guys talking and reading. But I do have 3 questions. And Joshua, you're an old hand at the Meat for Tea cast. You've been on before. I've got my 3 questions I ask at the end of every guest.
Fire away.
And the questions can actually take a while to answer. So I'm going to get to them now. So, Joshua and Rick, what are you guys reading these days?
I'm reading something I'm working on.
Cool.
Yeah. So it's a novel, but it's I'm just writing scene after scene after scene. And after I get all the scenes done, which probably ought to be in about a month, then it's kind of knitting them all together I'm having fun with it and makes me laugh. So
tell me more about it.
Well, when the pandemic started, I had this idea of putting a brother and a sister who are roughly about my age and who could have been me and my sister, who didn't like each other, but were confined to the same house because of the quarantine. And I started writing that like 3 years ago. And these other little characters who were nobody started popping up and screaming at me like, I'm better than they are. I'm a way better character. And you're going to have fun with me. And I thought, oh, what the hell? So I put it aside. And then I started listening to the voice again. And they did. They took over. The other two characters were still in it, but not nearly as prominent as they were. It's about a mill town, kind of like an East Hampton thing, or maybe a Northampton, but not as cool, not as rich. That was a mill town and has been, over the last 40 years, much like Northampton, has been turned into a cool town with a cool college and lots of coffee shops, and everything is overpriced. And there's people who lived there through this, kind of like Northampton. It was the Hamp people versus the NoHo people. Mm-hmm. And this one guy who's just an old crotchety, weird guy who lives by himself on what's left of his family's farm because he's been selling off the property, finds this guy who's been living in the shed in his house, in his farm, and doesn't even know it. And he finally catches him, and they become fast friends. And there's like a 55-year age difference of the two. And the guy hits the lottery and got a lot of money. So what do you want to do? I said, I want to own a bar so I can drink for free. And they buy this bar that needs rehabbing, and the guy that never blah 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 blah. Anyway, it's been fun, and it brings me into characters I know nothing about, but I have to learn. And that's blah blah blah. It's too early to talk.
It's not blah 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 to me. I'm so fascinated. I cannot wait to read this. Do you have a working title?
Blah blah blah.
There it is.
The name of the town is Fort Pleasant, which I find is there's a Fort Pleasant Avenue in Springfield, which I feel like, who the hell would name a fort Fort Pleasant? But that's always stuck with me. It was like a nice name for a town.
Sure.
So that's the name of the town. And the name of the bar they got is Junior's. I'm not sure why Junior's, but that's it. So something like that. I'm not sure what. And this, he wants it to be a sports bar, but the kid who was living in the shed, they decide to get married. They're not gay, but they decide to get married because this old guy says, look, I'm going to die before you, most likely. So it cuts out all the middlemen with lawyers and stuff. You just get everything. He says, all right. So they get married. And it's the bar, which the guy who's in the shed, who's an artist, makes it beautiful and stunningly beautiful with the paintings that he does. And it turns out to be a gay and lesbian sports bar primarily, which wasn't the intention, but it's cool. It's like everybody seems to like each other, and they get along, and it's anyway, that's where we are.
That sounds awesome.
Oh my God, I can't wait to read this.
The guy that was originally based on was a failed golf pro who moved out to Idaho and was there for like 30 some odd years as the head of a golf pro at a country club. But he gets fired basically for sleeping with too many women who he's giving lessons to. And he comes back to Fort Pleasant to find out that, lo and behold, he has a daughter, but he doesn't know who she is. And I just wrote something tonight where he finds out who she is and he throws up because he didn't expect this to happen. So,
do you want to read that little bit you wrote tonight?
I don't know how to get it on my computer here.
I'm so excited. I guess I just can't wait to get into this novel. So all the Meet for Tea Cast listeners are just going to have to all be super excited.
That's right.
And maybe Meet for Tea Press will publish this. We're thinking about moving out into bigger and bigger books, by the way.
I think you should, just for me, if nobody else. Thank you.
Well, yeah, we've got one coming out soon, Midnight Glossolalia, collection of poems by three poets. It's really cool the way they structured it. But
good idea.
Yeah. And that's, I think that's just over 100 pages. So it's a little, we're thinking about just going.
Mine was 112, I think it says.
Yeah. Why do I feel like this is a little bit bigger than yours was? I think it ended up being, the manuscript is just over 100, but once we got into book form, it ended up being more. I think that's what it was.
Yeah.
So we're getting larger.
Good.
As one does. I'm psyched for that.
Joshua, your turn.
What are you reading, Joshua?
I've been actually reading a lot of novels lately. I just finished reading John Steinbeck's Sweet Thursday.
I love that book.
And I love Steinbeck. One of my all-time favorite books, which apparently all the critics hated, was actually his last novel, which is Winter of Our Discontent. But I love Sweet Thursday, and of course I have already read, you know, Cannery Row and To Tail a Flat, but I read those years ago.
Well, he has three fans among us. That's true. Good.
Yeah. And there's this, don't ask me her name because I can't remember and I would screw it up anyways, but there is a novel called Convenience Store Girl, which is actually a modern Japanese novel. Yeah. And that is fantastic.
Ooh.
But right now, right in front of me, because, you know, when you ask me what I'm reading, I'm always reading like 15 books at the same time. But the two that's in front of me now is, one is called Anthropology, 101 True Love Stories by Dan Rhodes. And these are all stories that are exactly 101 words long.
Oh, you've told me about this.
Yes.
I want to read this.
And like in this book, like every story starts off with the, or not everyone, but almost all of them start off with my girlfriend. So like one will say, my girlfriend had always enjoyed showing off in front of foreigners. My girlfriend and I couldn't decide on a name for our little baby girl. And then, you know, he'll have that one sentence and then he'll just run with it. And, but it's very funny and quite enjoyable. And the other book I'm reading is actually John Shire's Too Wild.
Yeah.
Flash fiction collection, which I believe quite a few of these stories were published in Meat for Tea.
Yes.
And did that just recently come out?
No, you're thinking of his other book that of linked stories that's won like, I think, 37,000 awards or something.
Stumbling Through Adulthood.
Right.
I own it. I actually bought 5 signed copies, and that was Christmas gifts for brothers-in-law and wives and my dad, because I just thought everybody had to read it.
Yeah, this one came out in 2019.
I need to get that one. I really love his writing. It's really fun.
Yeah, so do I.
And he's a great guy.
So that's what I'm reading.
I just remembered something I was reading. I've been interested in math and physics for a long time, though I've never taken a physics class and I sucked at math. But I started reading crazily like 30 years ago, just, you know, like there's a shelf of books, let's go read them. And I got really interested in the universe and ideas of infinity and zero, and had some things published on academic journals that nobody ever reads, which was fine. But I've been involved with people with chaos theory for a long time. I had a Zoom meeting today, as a matter of fact, but at Springfield College, where I used to teach, I became pretty good friends with the math and physics department. We've had a reading group for about 6 or 8 years, something like that. And the one we're on now is a guy named Brian Greene, who's a physicist and writing about universe. And I think he's wrong, but but that's beside the point. I like reading that stuff.
Yeah, that's really cool. Now, Brian Greene, isn't he the string theory guy?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I know his stuff. He's fascinating.
Yeah. I think he's wrong.
I don't know that.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm qualified to
I'm not either. It doesn't matter.
I just don't know. I'm just intrigued.
And you think like the enormity of it. Like imagine like you've got a little kid as I did, but they're now all old. With you know, say like what's on the other side? You know, when does the universe end? And you go, well, yes, it does. Well, what's on the other side? Well, more universe. You know, that's a lousy answer. And instead of if the answer is like it doesn't end, like, well, that's a lousy answer. Like, Jesus, what's going on here? So I've been struggling with the notions of infinity and how we make sense of things, how a thing becomes a thing.
Cool.
Yeah. So I've been writing that too. But
I love that.
Yeah.
That's rich stuff. I can think about that. Well, anyone that can't think about that all day long needs to get their brain checked because there's a whole lot to think about there.
That's for sure.
Right?
Yep.
I think so.
Yeah.
So what are you guys listening to these days? What's on your on your turntable or whatever device you use?
I just discovered two new cats.
Nice.
One guy, his name is Vincent Neil Emerson. He's a country folk guy, but he's really modern. He kind of reminds me of, I guess the closest thing I can think of is Justin Townes Earl.
Okay, cool.
But he's different. He has a song called Willie Nelson's Wall. And one of the lines in the song is, "I'm as high as a fly on Willie Nelson's wall."
I love that.
And the other guy I discovered recently, his name is Charlie Crockett, and he is a black country singer who sounds like Hank Williams, early Hank Williams. Yeah. Oh,
wow.
Yeah. And of course, you know, I'm always listening to my jazz. You know, I can't go a day without listening to Charlie Parker or Miles Davis or Train or Monk or
you got good taste.
My go-tos. So
I get that.
I've been listening to people who are dead or near dead. I when David Crosby died, I went through YouTubes and watched and listened to song after song after song after song. And had a greater appreciation of him. I always thought of him as just the best ever harmony person. But man, oh man, I forgot about this one album that he did right after Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young sort of broke up, which I loved years ago, and I got back to that. And then Joni Mitchell, who I hope
I love her.
My God, the thing she did down at Newport this year.
Yeah, that was great.
Oh Jesus, and her. She's such a poet. My God, the stuff she writes, just the words, forget the music, which is also brilliant. Ah, way better than Bob Dylan.
She's a brilliant writer.
Yep, no doubt about it.
I'm a bigger fan of Joni Mitchell than I am of Bob Dylan.
Me too.
Yep. Definitely.
Me too.
There you have it. So We've settled it. Joni Mitchell is better than Bob Dylan.
Yes.
You heard it here first, folks, on the Meat for Tea cast.
Take note, I did not say anything about this.
You have an open prize, is that it? Is that why? You're a way better poet than he is.
Get ready for the hate emails. But I think it's true. Also, her visual art is amazing. Oh,
sure is.
She's just talented all around.
When I was a sophomore in college, I went to Springfield College, and they had this old field house, rickety thing, and she was performing there. And the place was packed. She got on late, and she sang three songs. And then around the third song, people were storming out of the place to go get beer because the package store is closed at like 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock.
Oh, rude.
And boom, 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 boom. And she took the guitar, she placed it on the chair and walked off the stage, right? And this one kid got up out of the stand, out of the crowd. I was like in the first row. The kid got out of the audience, goes up on stage and he goes, "Man, hey, man, we broke her heart, man. if we can clap really hard, she'll come back out. Like she was Tinkerbell. She's going to come back out if we clap really hard. You know, and of course she didn't. That was it.
She's like, no, fuck you.
Exactly.
Go get your beer.
Rightly so. Right.
Good for her.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So what are you guys watching these days?
I saw Bill Russell documentary last couple nights.
Ooh.
At the Center for the Celtics. God, what a guy. What a wonderful human being. Decent, smart, ballsy, not taking any crap, and a hell of a ball player and a hell of a human being. Very, very impressed by him. Always was.
Nice.
Honestly, I don't really watch a lot of TV. nothing really interesting. You know, I do my reading, I do my writing, I do all the other things I have to do, and I usually don't watch TV until, you know, the end of the night, and I usually just put on reruns of things I've already seen 1,000 times, like, you know, episodes of The Office or American Dad, and then I get in my rocking chair, and then one of my cats gets in my lap, and then I'm asleep within 15 minutes.
Anyway, I think those are great viewing choices.
I did. One thing I do is I collect. I do collect DVDs of old, you know, movies from the 1940s and 1950s, and I just bought myself a copy of The Maltese Falcon.
All right.
Oh,
so I'm
nice.
Just waiting for that to come in the mail so I can fall asleep within 15 minutes of watching that.
I love that old film noir.
Yeah. Yeah. So do I. That's my candy. That's my candy is all the film noir. I love, you know, old Raymond Chandler novels.
Yes.
This and going back to things I've read, the first novel I read of the year was every January I read a Chester Himes novel.
I love Chester Himes.
Yeah, I love Chester Himes too. I actually think I might like Chester Himes more than I do Raymond Chandler or Dashiell Hammett.
I think I agree.
So, yeah, I just started this tradition by accident that every January I read one of his novels. So
that's a really cool tradition. I love that.
Yeah.
No, what was the book? Devil in the Blue Dress?
That's not Chester Himes. That is, I forget his name, but that's not Chester Himes. That's someone heavily influenced by Chester Himes. Chester Himes wrote...
I definitely read Chester Himes in college, though. Now I'm just struggling
like
to find titles.
Yeah, like Crazy Kill and Blind Man with a Pistol. Heat of the Night, I think, is his most famous book.
I definitely read that. No, I took a class. I mean... I was doing an English major, well, English art, German minor, but one of the classes was detective fiction, which we all fondly nicknamed defective fiction.
Yeah.
But we learned all about the Black Mask Boys.
Oh, yeah. Walter Mosley, I think, wrote...
That's it, Walter Mosley. He's a good one, too.
He is.
He's great.
Yeah, he is great. But he's more contemporary.
Right.
Chester Himes was writing, he was writing more in the 50s and 60s, you know, whereas Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett was writing more in the 20s and 30s.
So, yeah. And that's where that private eye kind of diction.
Yeah, the hard-boiled crime.
Yeah. The dame walked into my office and legs went up to there and she was blonde and I knew she'd be trouble.
Yeah. What's her name? I can't think of her name now. I'm horrible with names. The one who wrote the book about, they have the TV show now with the women in the red dresses. You know it if the Handmaid's Tales.
Oh, that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who wrote
Margaret
it?
Margaret Atwood.
Yes, Margaret Atwood. She actually has a prose poem about her and falling in love with Raymond Chandler and the way he would talk about furniture. And it's amazing.
I love her.
Yeah.
I met her. She was doing a reading tour for her then new novel, The Heart Goes Last. And she was reading at Mount Holyoke College. So I gifted her with a copy of Meat for Tea signed by me to her.
Oh.
So as one does.
Yeah.
Good.
Didn't get an autograph from her, but she got mine.
She's telling her friends.
Yeah. Well, maybe she'll submit. That was the
yeah. Why not?
Yeah.
Well, there's been a couple of pretty famous folks to decide to publish their writing in there. You never know.
Yeah.
I certainly never feel shy in asking. This has been fun, guys.
It has been.
Yep.
Before it's fun, right? It's the next best thing to coming and sitting around our table and having a bite and doing this. And I think doing this whilst enjoying dinner would be tricky because there's the whole issue of when to chew.
Yeah.
So. Joshua, you want to remind people of the reading next week again?
Good idea.
Okay. The reading next week, which is In Time and Place, Poetry and Prose with Rick Parr and Joshua Michael Stewart, is at the East Long Meadow Public Library, which is located at 60 Center Square, East Long Meadow, Mass. And it is next Tuesday, February 21st, and it starts at 6:30 p.m.
So yay. Be there, or be a dodecahedron.
That's good.
So where can people find you and follow you on all the social media places?
Well, me, it's barely on Facebook, barely. You can email me anytime. rickparr@comcast.net. That's it. As you know, I stink with computers and stuff, so.
But you're on Facebook, and you're now part of the Meat for Tea Press Writers.
Yeah.
Facebook Messenger group, which is fun.
Yeah. Zuckerberg's got me by my short hairs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if he all the way has you that way. I think you're inactive enough that he's got a ways to go.
Yes. Oh, for sure. Right.
Yeah. What about you, Joshua? Where can everyone find you and follow you?
People can find me at joshuamichaelstewart.com. All my books are there. People can find my books on Amazon. And I am on Facebook under Joshua Michael Stewart. I'm usually the guy with the fedora. So that's how people can find me. I'm on Instagram. I used to be on Twitter, but I'm no longer on Twitter. But my website is probably the best place.
And that's simple, right?
Yep, joshuamichaelstewart.com.
As one would think. Rick, you should tell people where to buy your book.
On Amazon, for one, or what's the name of the bookstore in Northampton?
Broadside Books.
Broadside, right.
And also, fun fact, people that don't think Jeff Bezos needs money to buy another silly-shaped rocket, you don't want to shop at Amazon, which I get. You can just get the ISBN for the book off Amazon and go to your local independent bookstore and ask them to order it for you, and they will. And they might order a few extra copies, too.
Or just send me an email. I'll mail you one.
Or that. Or from Meat for Tea, but we need to get more copies because we just sold our last two.
Yay.
Yeah, I know. Well, guys, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for hanging with me tonight.
All right.
That was great, wasn't it? Hey, You can buy Rick Parr's book.
Yeah.
It's available. Go to our website. You'll see it for sale there.
Yep. And you can actually pick up Joshua Michael Stewart's book as well. I think we're going to put both the links
in the show notes.
Yeah, both of the places where you can get them, or all, some of the places.
If you don't want to support the evil empire that is behind funny shaped rocket ships, you can look up the ISBN on our website, and you can take that to your local indie bookstore and ask them to order a copy in for you. Oftentimes, not only will they order your copy, but they'll order a few extra store copies, and that really helps get our books out into indie bookstores and keeps you supporting your local indie booksellers.
That's a good thing.
It is.
Speaking of good things, we got another review.
Yay.
This one's on Apple Podcasts. 5-star review from SoCal Mick, SoCCAL Mick. Okay. I read it as SoCal because that's what I would figure it would be. But SoCal Mick writes, easygoing and accessible. The Meat for a Tea podcast is as relaxed and unpretentious as their zine. The hosts make me feel like I've dropped by for a spot of tea and good conversation with Elizabeth and Mark. It's a welcoming atmosphere, and I love hearing the featured artists read their work. Well, thank you, Mick.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much.
We're glad you like it. Thanks for listening.
You all should feel encouraged to leave us your 5-star reviews with writing, which you'll hear on the podcast. And I do urge you to put that into Apple Podcasts, copy and paste it, bring it on over into Good Pods, where we're still sitting at the number 2 spot in the top 100 indie performing arts podcasts. A little sad to see it slipping from number 1 spot, but no, a couple reviews from you guys and we'll be right up there at number 1 again. You can fix this.
Yeah, actually getting your friends to listen on Good Pods really helps that as well. So if you like what you're listening to, please spread the word.
Good Pods is cool.
Yeah, they are. They're very cool. So I think that about does it, doesn't it?
Yeah, thanks so much. Get your shop on. Meet Joy. Get yourself a new apron, a hoodie, a tote bag, a subscription to Meat for Tea, a pint glass, and a mug.
And a t-shirt.
And socks. And send us pictures. Socks. With you rocking your merchandise.
Yeah, all right. Again, the Meat for Tea Gmail is meatfortea@gmail.com, and the Meat for Tea Cast Gmail is meatfortecast@gmail.com. Either one works for certain kinds of correspondence. So
yeah, but the best place to post that picture would just be on the Meat for Tea Cast Facebook page or in the Meat for Tea Instagram account.
Ah, yes. Very good. Well, thanks again for sticking around, and we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Bye-bye.
The Meat for Tea cast is produced by Elizabeth McDuffie and Meat for Tea, The Valley Review. Mixed by Mark Allen Miller at Zone Lab, East Hampton, Massachusetts. Visit Meat for Tea at www.meatfortea.com. Please consider going to anchor.fm to make a contribution through our contribution page. You can reach us through meatforteacast@gmail.com, or you can leave a voice message at anchor.fm/meatforteacast. We welcome suggestions for contents for the Meat for Tea cast. If you've attended a Meat for Tea circ and want to hear from one of the bands or one of the spoken word contributors, please let us know. All portions are copyright Meat for Tea and their respective holders. Vote for Meat for Tea on your favorite podcast app. Follow us on Twitter @ElizaBeef, Meat for Tea on Instagram, and on the Meat for Tea and Meat for Tea cast Facebook pages. Meat for Tea is available everywhere you get your favorite podcasts.